The Apprenticeship Diaries, where raw meets refined. What it took, what it takes, and the stories that are made. Sit back and relax and join us for interviews with top tattoo artists. Hello, this is episode 18 with the Apprenticeship Diaries, and I'm here today with my father, Ronald Nichols. And he actually was, if you remember our first podcast episode, my mentor at first. He taught me how to cut hair. And whilst this, you know, seemingly might not be relevant to tattooing, I hope that some way you'll find that there's a lot of congruencies between the two. And more so, I think that we're heading to a place where, you know, we might find more, well-rounded legal forms of education within tattooing, more regulated forms of education in tattooing. And this, you know, cosmetology, barbership, all that stuff has been regulated for a very long time. Currently right now, if you'd like to find my dad, he's an excellent master barber and cosmetologist, senior cosmetologist. He's also an avid massage therapist at a Second Glance hair salon. He's really good. Say hi, Dad.
Hey, glad to be here.
So I wanted to, you know, first I'd like to hear your story, because I think that, you know, part of the reason why I started a podcast was because I think there's a lot of power in storytelling, and it's nice to hear about the people that came before you, because it gives you a lot of direction and a lot of insight in a non-aggressive way to your own path. And without, you know, without you being called out on anything you're doing wrong, you can assess through somebody else's experience where maybe your moves would be next. So what led you to hair, first of all?
Well, I actually, my family, my cousins mostly, were doing hair when I was young, and I lived with one of my second to oldest cousin. Her name is Kathy, and she lived down, we lived down in what they call Pigtown, Washington Boulevard. They used to run pigs down the street back in the 30s.
Really?
Yeah. That's cool. And that's why they call it a Pigtown. So anyway, it's off of Washington Boulevard, and she was going to school at the Baltimore School of Design. Mm-hmm. And I was working at Giant Food at the time, midnight to 8:30 in the morning. And in the summertime, I wouldn't go to bed coming home. I wouldn't just go to bed directly. I would usually stay up during the day and then sleep in the evening before I'd go back to work at midnight. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times in the summer, I would go down and hang out at the barber school, you know, just to see what was going on. And that's when I got interested in doing it, seeing them you know, work on people and all that. So I, from there, dropped that whole idea for a few years, and I met my wife. We were dating, and we got serious, mm-hmm. and she asked me one day, you know, this midnight shift is something I'd rather not do when we're married, if you want to get married, so maybe it's a good time for you to change your profession, because I wasn't happy at Giant. You know, I was stocking shelves, and it was pretty brutal work, hard to do, and the midnight wasn't real fun. So I told her that. She said, what do you think you'd like to do? And I said, well, I think I'd like to be a hairdresser. And after she got done laughing, you know, because she didn't see that coming at all.
Right. Not a lot of people did. In fact, people always ask me, like, you know, I don't know why your sexual orientation has anything to do with being a hairstylist. Yeah. But people are like, what, your dad's the hairstylist?
Yeah. I know. Well, there's more women in the profession than men, and the men that are in the profession are usually gay, you know. Mm-hmm. So, so then I went to school. I finished, did real well, and started out at a place that was very busy because I needed to make money. I was making good money at Giant, right. Had good insurance and stuff, so I needed to get all that under wraps. And of course, you know, I think you were coming along at that time, mm-hmm. and so I needed to, you know, get you settled. Was, you know, we were making babies and making a house, and so.
Well, and within that, Mom had to take her own hiatuses away from work, you know, in order to plan for that. So
exactly,
you had to hustle even more.
So after 6 years working at a salon, it was a sort of like a barbershop slash salon. It was a a nice barbershop, but it was a walk-in.
Yeah.
So as fast as you could cut the hair, the more you get people in your chair to make more money. And at first it was interesting because I really did well in school. And when I got into this barbershop, I started to really mess up a lot. And I was like, I guess it was the speed. It was, I didn't have any further training after
school.
Did
you think that that was the problem? Was that like there was really no real world kind of applicability to the information you got in school? Like you found that when you got in there was a disconnect between what you learned and what?
Yeah, that I think that was the problem. There was a disconnect because for a number of reasons. One was in school, a teacher can have up to 39 students that they're directing.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And basically you would cut the hair and they would come and check it. Mm-hmm. And then if you needed to make they would a lot of times just fix it for you. And you never really got the whole gist, you know? So when I got out and it was, I didn't pick a salon. I was offered a job where I would come out and be tutored under another salon program, you know. And I didn't choose that route because I needed to make money. I didn't think that I thought I was doing really good in school. And then when I got into the real world, I had to go faster and I was messing up a lot of stuff, you know. So then I did go to another school that was recommended by my boss. I was up in Pittsburgh. It was a further training, both in hairdressing and in barbering and cutting and all. So it was only 2 weeks, but it really helped me. It straightened me out, got me some a little bit better. So then after I was at that salon for 7 years, of course, I got really good and fast. Yeah. And in barbering, you know, you cut hair. That's all you do is cut hair.
Yeah,
you
that's really what the definition is. A lot of people don't know the difference between being a cosmetologist and being a barber. Barbers is just centered around the hair, the hair itself, perming, coloring, all that stuff. But it's solely hair, whereas cosmetology is skin, hair, nails, all of those things, and waxing.
Yeah.
So, you know, cosmetologists are more of like a, you know, a more universal license.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I left that salon and I opened up my own with a partner, Arlene.
Right.
In a place where it was mostly Jewish neighborhood. And we called the salon Aron's. So we figured people would read it as Aron's, which sounded fancy.
Or awesome.
It would read as Aaron's.
Right.
Which was a Jewish name. So either way, it was good. So, so we did very well there. We had a very small, it was only three stations. And I took $5,000. I bought the salon for $5,000.
That's inflation for you.
Amen. And Arlene came in with $5,000 and we gutted the place and remodeled it for $5,000. I did all the work myself.
Yep. And you usually do. And you have in the history of places that you've owned, you're very multi-faceted human, which is another feature that I love because you were always, I mean, the reason why I'm interviewing you is you've been, along with Mom, a very staunch mentor of mine, like, and in every kind of sense of things. But you in particular, you have more than Mom. Mom's teaching style is you got to get with it quick. And then, you know, if you don't, she's just not going to have much patience, but you're very patient and you're really good at breaking things down in a very technical way, which is cool.
Yeah. I think that's because that's the way I learned because, you know, as a child, you know, I never played with dolls or anything. So when I went to school, I had to really be taught in that way, breaking it down, you know, and like I said, I had to do some further education to do that.
Right.
So once I opened up that little salon, that lasted for 10 years. We were there.
Right.
And then I wanted to grow, and my partner didn't want to grow. She was happy with just that. And I wanted to get computerized. I wanted, that was when the computer age was coming in.
Yeah.
We had had to go through all the growing pains with those computer systems weren't stable back then. You know, they would crash all the time. We were still on a DOS system. And so when I bought a church.
This is where I remember, because this is when I was around 12, right?
Yeah.
This is when I mean, I remember eating all the sugar cubes and getting sick at your last one.
Yeah.
But that was about it.
Yeah, so we bought this.
And tacos, which is right next door. And taco ice cream.
Yeah, that was the small salon.
Yeah.
Right. That was in Randallstown. Yeah. So then we moved out to Carroll County. We bought a church, a Jehovah Witness Kingdom Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I bought the building because I wanted to own the building, and which I didn't own the other. I rented.
Right.
And then the church people, the Jehovah Witnesses, they rented back from me for a year.
Oh,
and
cool.
During that time, it gave me time to design the build out of the salon. It's a large space, you know, it's got upstairs and downstairs, and I wanted to do all the services. Yep. And so,
and you remodeled it yourself. And something that I've always liked about you is that you, when you meet professionals, you're very much so about building connections and trading services when you're in the service industry. And when you met a builder, a plumber and stuff, it was, you know, talk about that, because you were always, you know, very contingent that you wanted to be included in their knowledge.
Well, not only that, I wanted to work side by side with them. Every professional I hired, the agreement was that I would be their helper, you know, and sort of do a sweat equity type thing, you know. And that's when I really learned the building trade and how to do things and how to do all the facets of the building trades.
And so it was almost like procuring your own non-formal apprenticeship under these professional people.
Exactly. Yeah. And one guy that I hired to do a multifacets of things, name is Bob Pratt, and he grew up in the trades.
Yeah.
And he was very knowledgeable about everything, electrical, plumbing, and he was especially a carpenter, you know. So working alongside them, yes, it was like an apprenticeship. Yeah, it was. And I would go and work in his shop to build the cabinetry and everything. We built everything from scratch. And did the floor. I even came in, helped the guys do the floor, and so learned from them. So yeah, it was sort of like an apprenticeship. That was interesting, you know,
it's
informal.
Very cool. And also like very modern for its time. I mean, now the salon's a little dated because of, you know, it came from what, the 90s? Like,
yeah, 93 when we opened.
So you can tell it has that kind of air to it, which now we'd consider that more vintage feel.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Retro.
I know, it's retroactive now. But yeah, it was very modern when we built it out. Yeah.
But to give you credit, I mean, I remember when I was working here, which was a while ago, but I remember a professional coming in and he was trying to elicit services to do your outside maintenance. And he came in and just wanted to compliment us because he quickly saw that it was not necessary here. He was like, this is really well taken care of, actually. Like, I don't really see how I would be needed. But I wanted to know, like, who you got your services through. And, you know, he came to find out that you and Mom and, you know, us, mostly you, took care of everything. I mean, I remember, you know, you cleaning hair traps, you're replacing tile that gets broken. Anything that happens here, you have an action plan for and handle yourself.
Yeah.
Which, again, kind of factored into that need to make sure that you saved as much money as possible for our family, you know?
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And to be around that was really neat growing up.
Yeah, it's important to take care of your family. That was Mom and I both wanted to do that, make sure you got educated and stuff, you know, so how to put you through college and all. So,
well, it was cool. It was kind of like being part of a circus, too, because, like, I felt like, you know, the things that I played with growing up were, like, hair clips, and you'd have me stir paint as, like, a thing to keep me occupied, and, you know, let me show you how to do spackling and stuff like that, and this is how much you sand down drywall, and as a kid, I was just like, I'm happy to be there, you know?
Yeah.
I just was happy.
Yeah, well, I got to say that you're probably going to inherit most of my tools because you're a lot more of that than your brother, you know?
Yeah, but he's
he's good too, though.
He's good.
He's getting good.
I mean, I feel like Jared, and he's realizing how much I think because he is of a saving mindset and, mm-hmm. you know, he is about economics as well. He's seeing how much that empowers you to save money if you know how to do these things yourself.
Yeah.
Now he has his own family too. And he's also probably reminiscing about our own childhood and how cool it was to have a dad and a family that did a lot of stuff themselves because of what it showed your kids, the next mm-hmm. generation. And,
yeah.
and to, I mean, he can afford to just pay somebody, but I think it's him now realizing that showing that to his kids as a good way to be is a lot better, well, probably than mm-hmm. hiring somebody and hoping that they're going to make the kind of money he makes to sustain their life. It's probably a lot better a fail safe that you teach them tools how to take care of themselves if they need be.
Yeah.
So that's good.
It is good.
And you know, I think that's, you know, appropriate. That's usually how it goes, right? Mm-hmm. Like people have families and like you said, you know, your whole dynamic had to change because you started this family. So that's probably why. I always was, you know, anti-kids. So I knew, and I was reminded many times because I've screwed up a lot, that I had to take care of myself if this is the way that I chose to live my life. Mm-hmm. And so I had to really lean into acquiring a lot more skills. And fortunately for me, I have a lot of fun doing it. So, like, it's not... And I think that that's the truth the world around with our family is that we kind of enjoy work. You know, like, that's yeah. not something that we resent at all. We love it. You know, like... you know, our physical health, all of that stuff is, you know, we count on those things to keep moving. And yeah. that, again, was another thing that you and Mom really were about was health, maintaining your movement and all of those things, which, again, with tattooing, I've been warning people that if you don't keep moving and keep a regular regimen of movement in your life, your back's going to break, your hands are going to go. I was talking to Hannah and Dawn the other day because both of them are Hannah, remember Richie's girlfriend,
mm, right.
And Dawn's a bartender and she's having massive pains in her wrists right now. And I told her what you told me a long time ago when I started hair was that you cannot sleep with your wrists bent. You cannot do that. It's a third of your life that you spend. And if you are bending your hands like that at night, you're not going to be able to work. You have to get into a habit of sleeping with your wrists in alignment and be very aware of those things as much as you can. Now I've gotten to the point where I wake myself up at night if my hands start turning and curling. Like I can't mm-hmm. sleep through it. It doesn't comfort me. It does the opposite of what I think, you know, most people, that's a wombish kind of state is that you kind of curl up, but it's so bad for your joints. And you were really big about that because you've had to maintain this consistency throughout time. How long have you been cutting hair now?
It'll be 40 years.
Yeah. And you're not a...
Yeah, a lot of people, they can't continue doing it, their healthy, because mm-hmm. they don't take care of themselves. That's a big problem. Yep. So when you're standing on your feet all day and
yep.
your arms are up and you're out in front of you, you know, if you don't have... you don't work on building those muscles and mm-hmm. maintaining that, you know, you're going to have a problem. So yeah. that's important.
Well, and that was also big in my childhood too, is that, well, I was born with an underdeveloped hip. So right away, I think the recommendation was this, an awareness of keeping my hip from not being extended problems later on in life. And you and Mom already were really avid and physical and everything, mm-hmm. but you were told to put me in the water and you guys mm-hmm. already loved to swim. But throughout my whole life, I remember you being a person that always kept moving,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you, and you always pick things that kept you moving. Cause like in the very beginning, you know, I remember you telling me that like, you know, you weren't a naturally fit person, you know, mm-hmm. like you had to learn, you know, physical fitness that worked for you and keep that consistent in your life to allow you to do the things that you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember you being a triathlete. You've swam the Chesapeake Bay. How many times have you swam it?
Five times. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. And so like you've always had a regular connection to your physical awareness and body.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I grew up with that because, you know, I had no idea that that's something that not a lot of people get, you know, like that's something that I got that, you know, my whole life I've been challenged with this hip kind of thing that I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
But it could have been a hell of a lot worse if I didn't come from parents who gave me the tools to confront that. And now knowing that kind of regimen, I can walk into professions where if I see a pain in my body, I now know how to troubleshoot that.
Yeah.
You know, like if my back starts getting sore, I know my abdominals are weak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that I need to work on more core workouts. If, you know, my hands start hurting, I need to support my wrists in different ways and maybe, you know, use different machines or hold my body in different ways. But I don't feel victim to my body, which is something that you gave me as an experience growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, our podcast is meant to kind of highlight too, is like, if people are going to enter into profession, don't do it wide-eyed and bushy-tailed. Know what you're entering into. Like, it's fine, but you have to know that, you know, passion is only going to get you so far if you don't know certain ways to handle situations, and your physical health is so key to that too. And if you don't
I think it's important too that you really need to choose your mentor as much as your mentor chooses you. Because
yes.
That's very important, because when I started apprenticing people, which was probably about, I'd say, 10 years into the new salon.
Talk about that real quick, because why did you want to do that?
Well, because I started hiring people. You know, we had 26 people here working at one time, you know, at one point. And, you know, there was a lot going on. We were doing facials and manicuring and pedicuring, and we were doing massage, and we had assistants for each stylist. We had a bunch of assistants. We had a lot going on, and so I had to hire a lot of people. And when I was hiring people, I would get them out of school, and I found that they just were not adequately trained, you know, and I had to spend a lot of time with getting them up to speed. And I figured, well, you know, I'd rather get somebody that had the passion to be first, you know. So, and I found that a lot of times, especially coming out of like public school, those type of systems, the VOTEC system or whatever they call it today, was that those people were just doing it because they really just want to get out of schoolwork, you know. They weren't really passionate about what they wanted to do in any direction, really. So, you know, I would have to undo what they had learned and try to learn, you know, teach them the proper way. So I found it better that I'd rather just find somebody right off the street that maybe had an art background, or somebody that really just loved, you know, to work hard and learn something, and they just thought that they would love to do hair. So the apprenticeship that I would do, I would pay them, first of all. That was important to me, because I wanted to make sure that they could at least make a living. And in the hair industry, a lot of times people get apprentices and they don't pay them anything. And they just say, well, you're going to get educated free. You don't have to pay for school, so I'm going to educate you free. But that's a whole nother subject I'll talk about in a minute. But so I found out that paying them a decent wage, and also I did a 30-day
trial
period. And if they had to be able to come in on time, you know, they had to show a certain love for it, because a lot of times, you know, you get the impression you're going into a profession and you think you know what it is, but then you get in there and you start actually working it, and you're like, well, I don't think this is what I really wanted to do or what I thought it was, you know.
So give them an exit strategy.
Yeah, exactly. So I would pay them and all, but with the understanding there was no contract involved. But after 30 days, and I thought that they would do it and they felt comfortable doing it, I would have them sign a contract that they had to complete the project, you know, complete their training. In barbering, if they were a barber, it was, they had to complete 1,400 hours. And if they worked 40 hours a week, then that time went faster. You know, if they, you know, worked part-time, then it took longer, but they had to complete the hours, and I would have to send in monthly reports on them, their progress, what they did and all that, to the board, the state board of Maryland. And if they were training as a cosmetologist, and I would do both because I had both licenses. I had a master cosmetology license too. I could do both, but not at the same time. I had to do one at a time. So anyway, they had to train for 2 years, date to date. And the same thing, I have to send in progress reports. And a lot of times during these board meetings I would go to, the complaint was from the schools that these apprenticeships, the people weren't sending in the forms, and right. they weren't keeping it up, and that the people weren't properly trained.
But people were being abused.
And they were yeah. being abused. Yeah. So it's, you know, you
that
really
goes back
need
to the non-paid apprenticeships.
Yeah,
you've got to be very careful when
you
it
do.
Comes to that.
You should get some sort of pay. A lot of times, you know, they act as assistants and they get tips and stuff. You know, and that's all the pay they get. Now I paid them, and they got tips, but What I did was I would set aside one day a week, mm-hmm. let's say a Wednesday in the middle of the day, and I would give them like 5 hours mm-hmm. of one-on-one training, and the rest of the week they just acted as sort of my assistant. They would stand there and watch me cut hair. They would listen to me talk to the clients too, because that's very important.
That's key.
How you address the client, how you treat the client, how you listen to them, how you reiterate what's called parroting back to them.
I remember even when I was the front end person, like the education you gave me there, because you sent me to a seminar, and all of that seminar was about client interaction and the right way to address somebody when you're handling a front end. So, you know, HR is huge when you're doing this level of service industry.
And when you're in the service industry, no matter what the service industry is, that's key. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you can go and get dinner anywhere, you can go to McDonald's and get a dinner, but you can go to, you know, a really fancy restaurant and have an experience,
yes.
you know. So the experience is what you want to give them, you know.
Yes.
So that's what I taught them to do. And if you're in the service industry and you're trying to build a clientele, mm-hmm. It's all about, you know, you have people in your chair, then they go and they can tell someone else about an experience they had, mm-hmm. or they can just go and they had their hair cut and not tell anybody.
Right.
So, you know, it's really the wow factor. You know,
right.
you want to wow them.
Right.
And that all comes from how you, you know, interact with them. So they felt like they were being treated by someone who loved what they did, mm-hmm. knew what they were doing.
Very well.
And that's really what everybody wants. You
well,
know,
to
so.
Me, yeah, that is. It's that's how the whole system kind of comes full circle. Because, you know, I think sometimes people get caught up about prices of things or how you can justify a price of something. But what they don't really, you know, understand about that is that they're getting so much more than a haircut or a cup of coffee or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're getting an experience, and that's what they're really buying.
Well, I always told people, you know, everybody's got money to spend,
right?
But it's up to them where they want to spend
yeah.
it and how much they're willing to spend on
right.
it. So, if I like archery,
right?
So I might go spend $12 for an arrow, where you can get an arrow at Walmart for $1.59.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't mind spending $12 on the arrow because I know how much better it is
right.
and how much more precision it is.
Well, if you look into that too, like I feel a lot better about paying high dollar prices for something that I know in its making has a full circle effect. Like if they're considering the environment, if they're considering education of their employees, if they're treating their employees to a certain level. Like I found out from my friend Mike that owns he runs a maintenance mechanics place for BMW. And I was, you know, complaining to him that my Hyundai, you know, I went and got service at their Hyundai dealership and was really not pleased because I felt like they duped me into extending my, you know, going past my warranty so that then they, you know, could charge me all this money for something that should have been under warranty. And he's like, well, the reason why they do that is because the service people, the actual mechanics, only get paid 50% to honor those warranties that they give out. And he's like, that's not what happens when you buy a luxury vehicle. That's why people buy luxury vehicles, is because when they go, they're buying not just a car, but, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. Like, their warranties are going to be, you know, beautifully upheld. All the people, all the moving parts are going to be taken care of. And that's why people buy into it, because it's about ultimately procuring quality and saving time. Mm-hmm. And it's great. And I was like, yes, because I would have happily paid more to have my time looked after, because that's what really pissed me off. I have no problem, you know, shoveling out a lot of money if I know that it's going to save my time and get me back on the road faster. Mm-hmm. But I have a lot of problem dishing out a bunch of money to something that I know is not a good product. And that's when people feel cheated.
Yeah.
And to me, that's really what you have to look at when you're looking at business ethics, is that, you know, are you considering all things? And that's what you were building here, was that, you really wanted quality product to your, you know, customers, and you wanted a place that, you know, you left a situation where you had a partnership, right? And you wanted to have a vision realized,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it was all about a vision. You know, when you want to get into your own business or you have your own shop, that's what it is. You want to create something that's yours, and you want to make it the way you want to make it. So,
right. So
when I did the apprenticeships, I would set aside that time for them to mm-hmm. train them.
Right.
And then they would work with side by side with me closely.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was training them, I would see when they were ready to actually start doing clients.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell the client that they're an apprentice, and I would tell the client that I'm going to oversee what they do
mm-hmm.
and that they are capable of doing what they came in to have the service done. They're capable of doing it. And I would charge the client,
mm-hmm.
but I would charge them a lesser fee,
right.
You know, for that work. And the clients, a lot of times, especially ones that were on a tight budget, they loved the apprentices.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then what happened then was that by the time the apprentice was finished their apprenticeship, they had a full book,
right.
And they were ready to go. And that's what I would try to tell people, that a lot of people would say, well, I'm going to go to school because it's a shorter time, and when I get out, I have my license and I can go. But the problem was, they were coming out of school competing against people that were more qualified than them,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't have any clientele at all.
And they have professionals help them, because
yeah,
how would they help somebody?
Well, sure, because they're competitors. Sure. So,
yeah.
In an apprenticeship, you worked a little longer to get your license,
mm-hmm.
but by the time you were done, you were already booked.
Fully booked, and
if you were good,
yes.
If you were good at doing it,
yes.
So. So and that's the other thing about apprenticeships and the mentorship as far as the apprenticeship goes.
Mm-hmm.
The way I found was that the way I taught people was very different.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, some people I had to really break it down. You know, like, I mean, it was like, you know, painting by numbers, you know,
right.
it's just, they loved it. They had passion, but they really had to learn
yeah.
like the nitty gritty. And then
yeah.
other people like you
mm-hmm.
had all this artistic background. Plus you probably were just naturally good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to sort of let you go a lot more.
Well, and I'm stubborn. I've just grown to realize.
Well,
that,
you were breaking the rules before you fully knew the rules, you know, and then,
right.
But you know, you could always work it out because you have a great eye. You can just look at something, but
right. It's become problematic though for me, because part of the reason why I did this was because I took on an apprentice, and what I realized within that station as a being a mentor was that I am a very uneducated mentor. I'm not good at teaching. I feel a lot more like mom in the way that I teach, because I think a lot of her knowledge is intuitive, and she can't understand why other people don't see
exactly.
things the way that she sees it. And that's how I am, is like, I have very little ability to break things down technically to my students, who need that at times. Like my first apprentice, she really needed it. And I was ill-equipped, and I don't necessarily know what I'm doing. I'm just doing it.
You had the same problem when you apprenticed a hair.
Yeah.
Because you apprenticed a hair person.
Yes.
And I remember that. You were getting frustrated with them because
mm-hmm.
they weren't getting it.
Yeah.
Well, that's because you could just look at it and see it, you know,
mm-hmm.
but you couldn't understand why they couldn't see it.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, there is a big difference in actually teaching and doing, you know, so, so I had to just let you go and in a lot of cases. And then every once in a while you would say, you know, this color didn't come out right or something. And then I'd say, no problem. And I would show you how to fix it, you know, so, but that's because.
And I honestly feel like I rode high off of a lot of other skills that I had too. I mean, I'm a gregarious person, I know. And plus you started me at the front end first, which I think was very incremental about how I knew to interact with my clients and interact with the front end and be hospitable to mm-hmm. people. Like, I remember Kelly when she worked with us for a while. And, you know, she was one of those people that just lit up a room. Mm-hmm. And she had such a catching personality that nobody cared what she did, really. Like, yeah. She got off with a lot of crap just because you couldn't help but love her. And yeah. I remember taking over some of her clients and I was like, who the hell cut your hair last? And they go, oh, Kelly. And I was like, dude, do you know that this whole side of your head's longer? They're like, yeah, it's always been that way. But I love her so much.
Yeah.
And I do. I think a lot of it was that people just genuinely liked me. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, you were fully booked. And I remember I had to up your pay, you know, before you even got your license, you know, mm-hmm. because you were doing so well and everybody loved you. And but you're just a good worker, you know, all the way
yeah,
around.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, coming, I feel it's funny because now in my profession, like the worst people that I deal with are engineers because they're a lot like me.
Mm-hmm.
They have this vision that they know very well, but they have no ability to communicate. And when you're trying to commission work from people, you have to be very clear about how you're outlining your idea, and especially if you're having a creative, a hairstylist and all that stuff mm-hmm. take on a vision of yours and make it happen for you, you have to be really good at breaking it down. And they're not. And I'm realizing, much like them, when it comes to teaching people, I'm very the same. Like I think that's the truth about a lot of things. Usually what you end up not liking in other people is something that's very, you know, congruent with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a challenge that you should probably reflect back on and go, well, I don't like this about somebody else, but in all conscious seeking world, you know, is that something that's about myself? Like, should I, you know, think about that? And that was something that I found a link to when I became a mentor, especially in tattooing. And, you know, I think that my genuine in-depth concern about my apprentice, and it's sad to say, but is more so with my tattoo apprentice, because she's my friend on top of everything. I mean, Dylan, who was my apprentice in hair,
mm-hmm.
I met him and he said he wanted to do it. And I was trying to transition out of here. So I was trying to put somebody in my seat. So mm-hmm. I think the intention was a lot more, I wanted to expedite it and I couldn't. And with Andrea, it was a very genuine want to teach somebody and give them a profession. But what I found was that I'm very flawed as a teacher. And it was good. And fortunately, she came from a teaching background. So, and I warned her, I told her, you know, I'm picking you because you're easy. You know, I'm picking you because
she's already really talented.
Oh, very talented. Mm-hmm. She doesn't think she's as talented as she is, but that's her biggest problem, is getting in out of her own way. And she knows that now, like in our times, we've actually learned a lot together in this experience. Like you said, picking your mentor is so vital, you know, that both you and the mentor have this really good relationship. That's built on, you know, honest communication, lots of vulnerability, you know, that you're a good pairing. And what I found is that I was really good for Andrea when it came to the calm and the anxiety that she has at times, that I created a lot of anxiety for her at times within my education with her. But then I also was able to talk through a lot of that stuff with her. And I think now she is a lot more sated in just who she is as a person, mm-hmm. which, you know, when you're going into a profession, her biggest thing that she announced when we interviewed her was that you got to know yourself, man. Know yourself before you go into a profession. Make sure you know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that will help you so much find out, who a good mentor is, because then you'll know what you need. And if you don't know what you need, then it's going to be a really hard thing to navigate that scenario. And she made it work, I think, with us. I think I was a little cocksure, like I usually am about most things. And she was like, Amy, I don't know how you do this. I said, well, I don't know either. I just happen to be more confident than the average person. That doesn't mean that I'm actually smart.
I think you got confidence from your mother, because she had no problem telling you, you know, that hand doesn't look right when you draw that. I mean, it's too big, you know.
Yeah.
And we would always just be straightforward with you. But, you know, when you're mentoring people, you have to know that about them, that they can take that criticism.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know yourself when you went to school at Carver, you know, you would see kids crying because you'd all be, you know, critiquing their work, and they would be so upset because no one ever critiqued their work.
Ever,
you know, yeah. So we always did that to you. We always just told you straight out, you know. So when I was mentoring you with hair, it was no problem. I would say, that's not good. You got to do this and do that. And you were like, oh, okay. So you would just say, okay.
Right.
You know, and that was it. But I couldn't do that with everybody, you know. That. So I always consider myself a better teacher than an actual hairstylist, you know. I mean, I'm very adequate and I'm consistent. And that's another thing.
Yeah.
And hair, it's consistency, see? And it's a little different, I guess, than in tattooing, because tattooing is a one shot and it's for life.
Yeah.
Hair grows back, you know? So it was an interesting thing when I used to watch my teacher in school, and he had a guy come in every 2 weeks, and he would cut his hair. And one day I said to him, I said, Lee, I don't understand. What can possibly grow in 2 weeks, you know? And he said, Ron, this is the most important thing I'm going to teach you while you're here in school. It's not what you cut off the head. It's what you leave on. Whatever you cut off stays on the floor.
Right.
This guy wants to look the same all the time. So I cut off 2 weeks of hair, and that's it. And it's consistent. If I cut it too short, then that's why he comes to me, you know, because somebody else always cuts it too short or somebody lifts it too long. You know, it's consistency. You know, that was the consistency. So I'm very consistent. And I think that's what made me,
successful. Meanwhile, I wasn't. But see, here's where we're different, is that I had Fran, for example. Do you know Fran, like the business guy? He's real cool.
Yeah.
I liked him a lot. But I mean, he went to me my entire life, and now I'm sure he goes to you, or, you know, he found somebody else. But he was always, you know, his secretaries would make his appointments for him. And I remember him every single time. He was like, you know, you've never cut my hair as well as the first time. And I was like, well, Fran, you keep coming back. He's like, yeah, it's just with the hope that maybe you'll cut my hair. It's awesome. But I think it was that he really liked me.
Yeah.
But I was not as consistent with you. But I think that that's what I think the congruent, there's many congruent things. I think that hair is a foreshadowing of what tattooing will ultimately become if legislation gets more involved in it. So I think that the things that we're talking about right now, that's why I'm interviewing you too, is that I think that these are something that if our industry hopes to head that off in a way that's going to keep the control where it needs to be, which is within the professionals' hands, and, you know, the people who do actually have the education, we should set some things in play much like that and see some of this coming. And I think with hair, since it's such a beautiful outline and we can already see so much of what is going to come at us, it's a nice thing. But within it, personal branding is such a huge thing. And your clientele is based on your own personal brand. Mine was never a mode of consistency, and I lost a lot of clients who wanted a consistent haircut. My clientele were for the wacky people. They were people who were like, I want this new extreme haircut that does this, or I want this funky color that goes here or there, and or I, you know, like they were on the fringe, and I had a lot of young kids that came to me who I had to kind of do the talking between them and their parents, who were like, they wanted their hair out of their face. Meanwhile, the kid wanted a fashion friendly, you know, cut. So I had to, you know,
You're going to acquire your own style, and you're going to attract those right. certain types of people. Each right. one of us attracts certain people.
Right.
Mine are more the business people that yes. want to look the same all the time, and, yes. and you know, and that's a different thing. I don't tend to do the wild, crazy stuff.
Anymore. And I love it. Like as you're, I remember when all those colors really came out. You're like, Christ's sake, this is something that I spent most of my life trying to avoid getting these colors.
I know. The hair turns blue.
And you're like, crap.
That was bad when I was.
And now everybody's like, I want it.
Yeah,
like,
now everyone wants blue hair. Yeah. Oh, man.
And then, you know, that's his own thing because then you got to talk him through. Well, you know, the maintenance of keeping your hair blue is actually really high. And,
that's the thing.
They don't realize the management of those things. So, and again, you know, that was something I really liked about the way I watched you and observed you is that, you know, even down to products, you were really good about educating yourself about what that product did because you knew that that helped you sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew you could sell ethically to people as well with that kind of knowledge. And you didn't have products in your salon that you felt were questionable or, you know, crap.
Yeah, I would read the ingredients label and then I'd go and I would research, you know, the words that were, you know, 50 letters long and mm-hmm. what they did and why they did it and what it's going to do for your hair. And yeah, it's right. It is. You're educating your clients to what they're buying.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that all comes back to the value. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a value in it, why it works better than something else and why you want to buy it.
Yep.
So, yeah, that was important.
Yeah, well, and it keeps people from being cheated. Do you remember that time when Annabelle came in and she was looking at those crap hair dryers that we mm-hmm. had bought? They just were a bad test run of those Ionic hair dryers, but the minute you dropped them, they broke.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you really didn't have to drop them hard or anything. They would break, like, very, and they were like, what? Like, were they like $120 hair dryer? And she came in and she was like, tell me about this hair dryer. I said, it's crap.
Yeah.
And she was like, what? What would your dad have to say about that? I said, he's going to tell you it's crap. We are going to take them off the shelf very soon.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was amazed that I would just, she's like, I can't believe that you would say that. And I was like, I'm saying it because it's true.
Yeah.
And because I know that I can't sell you a piece of crap like that and feel good about it. Like, I care too much about you. And when you walked up, she asked you, you know, what do you think about this? And you're like, oh, they're crap. I'm sending them back. And so I told her, I was like, Annabelle, I'll sell you products all day, hon, but I'm only going to sell you products that I feel good about giving you. And if you, you know, if you feel like you need an Ionic hair, to me, my opinion personally, you have to have a crap ton of hair to need a $120 hair dryer. Like, and there are people that applies to, but for you, I think you're more of a, let me sell you some products to safeguard how long your hair is and things like mm-hmm. that when you dry it, and then just get a $20 hair dryer from Walmart. And she's like, I can't believe you would say that. And I was like, well, crap. I mean, I'm not trying to sell you a lie. And I was taught that you sell people things that will help them experience. And that was the other thing that I like about, you know, it should be a service. It should be something where you're looking out for a person that there's, you know, you're not trying to get one. You're trying to make them feel awesome. And that's something that I really, I think has been something I carried over into the tattoo industry that I think has been pivotal to my life there.
That's why you're so busy.
Yeah.
It's a big part of it.
Yeah. And I think my clients.
I mean, your work is great. It's beautiful, but you also know how to treat people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah. And they come for a lot of atonement, too. I feel they get that there because it's a safe environment where they can actually not be anxiety induced about what they're going to get. Our studio has really tried to make it a kind of safe space for our clients where they're being heard and they are safeguarded in this thing that they're going to do that's huge. I mean, like you said, it lasts forever. It's
mm-hmm.
it's not something that will grow back. So there's a lot more, even though I say that, there's a lot more anxiety about it or potential, but I've found a lot more people have come at me for a bad haircut than a bad tattoo.
Yeah.
Which is weird, but
crown of glory, right?
Yeah. It's amazing how many people will, you know, risk their skin permanently, as opposed to people who are, you know, they're very trepidatious about getting their hair cut by a novice. And one of the things that I would actually tell people when I was an apprentice is, look, you got the opportunity to sculpt me the way that you want to. Like, I'm kind of a blank canvas to which, you know, like you said, I'm very open to hearing critique. if somebody comes to me and they say, this was a little off, I now know, you know, what this client is. And I have a good memory for people and what their wants are. Like, I think that, I don't know if it's always been there in me, just a very complacent personality that loves to please people. But I really like pleasing people and making sure that they're heard and understood. And when I would meet people for the first time and cutting their hair, I'm like, look, let's start this off good. And you just realize that nowhere in my want to cut hair was there a want to mess up yours. So let's start there and realize that we're both here with an earnest want to succeed here. Mm-hmm. And I'm ready to listen to you, and you can talk to me, but you have to. You have to tell me.
Yeah.
And they were really comforted by that. And that's what I've carried on into my tattoo life too, is that this has to be something where you are able and willing to communicate. And don't think that I'm attached, you know, to, like, I'm attached, but I'm going to advise you within, I think, a value system that's about your own well-being. That's what I'm mostly attached to. And I know that I look at art more than you do. So when it comes to high art and you're commissioning an artist, you want to trust your professional a little bit. And if they're trying to lead you down a good path, don't be so, you know, resistant.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all stuff that you taught me, was that, like, sometimes you really have to know how to handle people and where you know a little bit more than they do and how to manage their anxiety within that moment. And honestly, I think that that's what allowed me to teach Andrea pretty well, is that, like, once I saw her panicking, I kind of rushed in and was like, oh, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Let's sit down. Let's have a jam session for a second. Let me talk you through some of this stuff. Cause that's honestly all she needed.
Mm-hmm.
She has all the stuff that she needs to do. Like me, I think she is very intuitive. I think she's just, it's her anxiety that it gets paralyzing to her, and she just needs to get it out a little bit, and then she's fine.
Yeah.
Which is awesome, you know, like, that's a really cool thing. And now she just knows that she needs to talk it through, and we do that for each other, and I don't mind it one bit. Like, yeah. It's cool. But yeah, you do have to find your rhythm.
Yeah, you do. And I think you have to be confident with yourself, because sometimes you have to be a little forceful with clients. You know, you have to be a little bit, hey, you know, that's not going to look right, you know, and,
right.
You know, believe me, you know,
right.
I'm saying this for your own good, you know,
right.
And I can prove it to you, you know,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then, and that way.
And you even invested in systems where people could see different haircuts on themselves, which is cool.
I know. That was way ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It had like this ability to, take a picture of the person's face, and then they were like bald on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and then you could float hairstyles on them.
Yeah,
change the color.
Yeah,
and stuff,
and people could kind of see their face
with
different things.
Yeah,
but yeah, like, there was a lot of times either the look wouldn't look right, or it wouldn't be suitable for their lifestyle. And I feel like some people, you know, if they had certain kinds of hair types, you're like, I can cut your hair that way,
mm-hmm.
but you know, as far as the, you know, the way that you're going to feel about this cut, you're not going to like it the way you mm-hmm. like it on this other person, because you're going to actually have to manage it and make it look like this every day. And just the way that your hair is, that's going to be a lot of work.
I think it's good when you first start out, too, that you should design some sort of methodology for your dialogue. For
mm-hmm.
example, you have some people sit in your chair and you try, they don't want to say anything, you know, they don't want to talk about what they want. So you might want to start out with an hair. You might say, okay, you know, how much are you willing to cut off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they may say, well, you know, I only want a little bit cut off. Well, you know, if you only, my inch and your inch is different, you know,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and then of course on combs, all styling combs have a measuring device on them. You would
mm-hmm.
say, this is an inch, but your hair really needs, you know, at least 2 inches off, because it's just not going to do anything for you if you
right.
don't, you know.
What's
and
the point
then,
of this haircut if not to maintain the health and condition of your hair?
Yeah. And a lot of times men will come in and say, well, I want to cut over my ear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that could mean that they want to cut around their ear, mm-hmm. over top of their ear, or they want to cut over their ear, like covering their ear.
Right.
So you better really parrot back to them what you're hearing, you know.
Yeah.
Well, so that way it's important, you know. So, yeah, and then you just got to learn a dialogue of questions, you know. Maybe even design a script,
right.
even helps. I had scripts for people that were young, you know, really starting out, and that was helpful.
Well, that's important because I came at it twice, and I needed, I think, if I am to assess myself, a lot more life under me beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I think therapy helped that, because that's something they say in therapy is that, you know, you're supposed to parrot, you're supposed to mirror back for clarity. You know, this is what I heard you say. This is how I took that. Is that what you meant?
Mm-hmm.
And that's proper consulting advice, yeah. in general. And you know, I have to do consultations with my clients all the time and make sure that I'm very clear. And, you know, some of our girls like to do it virtually via email, but I've been asked lots why I like to do them in person. And I'm like, just because I feel like it splits the difference so much faster. I mean, if I can see this person, I can watch their attitude. I mean, to me, it's so much more than the thing itself. Like, I can't assume anything. And that was another thing that you taught me as a teacher in writing. You know, you always taught me that when you're writing things, you can't assume that your audience knows anything. Like, you have to kind of make them an alien to what mm-hmm. you're saying in your mind and try to break it down really small and never jump to assumption or work out of it, because that's how you're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, I remember one story you wrote. You were writing about Indians, you know, about something in
like,
school.
What Indians?
Yeah, I said, what kind of Indian is it? You know, do they have a dot, you know, when they're, you know,
right,
are they from India, or are they
right.
like American Indians?
Right.
Or, you know, you're not telling me anything in what you're writing here, you know,
right.
so yeah.
Yeah.
You had it in your head,
right?
But you didn't put it on the paper.
Yep.
That was the, yeah. So.
Yeah, and then that has been, that's been a struggle of mine my whole life. And that was something when I went into therapy was boundaries and understanding how to lay them out, the nonviolence of boundaries, and how it, in the end, it just makes sure that everybody's clear and mm-hmm. they know how to move forward safely, procuring everyone's safety. But it seems very nasty to set a boundary like that sometimes, especially with somebody like me who, for as long as I can remember, when it came to conflict or anything, I would just look around and be like, I don't even understand why we're doing this. Like, mm-hmm. why aren't we all just getting along? Because in my mind, everything seemed so clear and always so, like, it just seemed ridiculous for me, some of the conflicts.
Well, especially when somebody comes and they sit in your chair or they sit with you for the first time, they come from a completely different background.
Yeah.
You know, words that are hot buttons for them that may be insulting may be something you said in your family of origin just as a joke, you
yeah.
know. So, you know, you got to read people, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I don't see how you can do that in an email. You know, you need
no.
to look at their body language, you mm-hmm. need to look at their expressions, their facial expressions
yep.
from what you're saying. And when you see things, you know to avoid certain ways of talking about
right.
things, or, you know, and I had some people in my chair one time. I can remember I had this woman, no matter what I said, it was wrong. And and she just, you know, finally I just said, you know what, I don't think it's a good idea that I do your hair
right.
at all. I'm seriously, I mean, it's just
yeah.
not a good idea.
Yeah, we're not going to have a good time.
No, it's just not going to work. You know, no matter what I said, I could tell she was just really like, man, it was, I don't know why she even bothered to sit there, you know. It was crazy.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm a big advocate of firing your clients if
yeah.
need be.
I have fired quite a few.
Yeah.
Because you have to. I mean,
I'm glad that you showed me that, though. I mean, you say that, but I actually ran into a hairstylist from Texas, and she worked at a place, and she was appalled. I mean, not appalled, but she was, I think more of the word would be intrigued, because she was like, what? You're allowed to do that? And I said, yeah. And she goes, oh, it must be because you work for your dad. And I was like, I mean, maybe. But I said, I learned that that is not going to be a beneficial relationship for anyone.
Yeah.
And it was proposed to me that that's not business that we want. you know, like, I would rather pay that client to never come back than have them regularly be a pain in my ass.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh my God, if my employer ever found out that I fired a client, I would be fired. And I was like, well, that's a very unfortunate working scenario, in my opinion, my friend. So, and that's something that
Well, you want to build a clientele that you are happy with, because if you're not happy doing it, you're just going to not want to do it, you know, so that's not good.
Yes.
That's stupid.
And what I found with a lot of creatives, too, is this knee-jerk reaction to business and money and those exchange. They see a lot of violence with those things and a lot of apprehension to set good boundaries that ensure not only their own safety in working, but their clients as well, and make sure that they're firm about those things. I mean, I struggle with it all the time, but that's kind of the reason why I think my learning style is more, or teaching style is more about teaching people to be confident in themselves and to trust themselves, because I think that, you know, I think we live in a free market, or at least that's what I'm hoping that we are moving towards. And, you know, with the lot of freedoms that we have in this country to procure whatever we want, to me it's essential that you understand your brand, and that you understand also that, like, there's an existence for this form of business and this form of business, and everybody gets to pick what they want. And instead of actually competing, you end up feeding your friends in the end, if that's how you end up doing things. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, cutthroat industry where everybody's cash grabbing. We're actually procuring everybody's safety and individuality and saying, well, I mean, that's not what I do, but this person over here does.
Yeah, I had a woman come in. She had like ridiculous amount of kids. I think she had 9 children or something.
Whoa,
and I just, you know, I'd do her hair, but then she'd say, well, I want to bring my kids. And I'd say, no, why don't you just take them to the hair cuttery or something, you know?
Well, because
this is too many kids.
Right.
I mean, it's too expensive. We're too expensive, you know?
Yes.
You know, there's a market for everybody. There's a market for everything, you know? So
besides the fact that, you know, in all honesty, what you were moving towards in your vision was more of a high-end service industry kind of basis, where it wasn't about how quickly it could be done or efficiently or cost-effectively. It was about people taking time out of their day to replenish and actually, you know, like you said, get massage, get facials, get waxings, you know, like it became appointment only, where, you know, it would be hard not to laugh at somebody who called the day of a Saturday. I mean, are you joking? You can't get in right now.
Yeah.
And it became that kind of business. And, you know, we run into that a lot at our business because we're an appointment only studio. And just the other day I had somebody show up and they were like, oh, do you guys do piercings? And they just showed up and we're like, no. No, neither do we do piercings, neither do we advertise that we do piercings. The place below us doesn't do piercings either. They're a tattoo and piercing supply company. And more than that, even if we did, we'd be an appointment-only basis. And I've had similar conversations with people who want small tattoos that are really just meant for a walk-in kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And not to besmudge what they want. It's never to say, like, what you want is wrong. It's just that if you go to the wrong kind of place to get it, you're gonna get upset because they're not gonna treat you with the kind of, you know, thing that you're wanting to get. You know, like, they're not gonna just immediately give you what you want. And, you know, that's the thing, is like our minimum at our shop is $100. But a lot of other shops, it's like $60, $80. Why would you want to get a little tattoo that anyone can do and pay $100 for it? What? Why?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it makes no sense. Like, it really doesn't. Like, the difference between what I'm going to do and somebody else for an infinity symbol, not much. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
it that's a good way to be. And again, that's just being ethical when you're talking to your clients and you're looking out for everyone.
Yeah.
So that's good. And, you know, I honestly, with me and Rico, like, that's been a great thing within our relationship, because he comes from a business family as well. And just the level of knowledge within that, you know, when you are born to somebody who has literally built something that was never there, you know, and made this run for so long, and what they learned along the way, and watching you guys experience that it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I got such insight without I mean, I'm a college dropout, but I think that my knowledge of, you know, how to function in the world is so secure without having a degree, you know? And I think that's why. It's because I got a lot of background information always fed to me. And that's why I really love apprenticeships. Like, I actually interviewed a lady recently. Her name's Lisa Dahl, and she was one of the few that took up this. They created this tattoo school kind of like show at one point, and she actually used her husband's GI Bill to do, and it covered technical schools. And she was able to attend this, and she got lambasted by the tattoo community because they're so fervent about having apprenticeship be the only way that you learn. And they thought it was ridiculous that these people were sitting there for 2 weeks and then off, able to be a tattoo artist. But what she said to me was, is that I think there should be both. There should be both apprenticeship, much like the hair industry, there should be both apprenticeships and there should be technical schools, because she said, actually, 2 weeks was very thorough and very in-depth, and they did have a lot more one-on-one than you would expect, and the fundamentals were there. And I was able to take that and go. And like you said, you needed furthering education past your school. You went to a 2 week course that was very immersive. And so for me to have a multi-tiered route to education is really, really good. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why I wanted to do this podcast, is to talk to people about, one, you know, like what I see coming in our future with tattooing, because it's climbing in notoriety and people, more people are doing it. And also because I feel like when I first started here, I remember my boss, John, me telling him that I really wanted to streamline the education in this industry because I thought it was so great for budding artists, you know, such a great way to make money because you get to be your own entity. And it's so, and I feel like it's to the core of what an artist is, like, you know, the way that we get to perform our tasks and the way that we connect to our community is so ingratiated in being a tattoo artist. Like, I found such peace there. Not only, like I said, I'm a very complacent person. I love pleasing people. You know, for me to mix my art with, you know, hospitality is awesome. You know, that's really cool. And I think overall it sculpts a very savvy professional because of, you know, all the things that you just talked about. You know, you have to, you know, take your own education in your own hands. You have to be business savvy. You have to be people savvy. You have to, you know, recognize trends in technology to advance your business and move with them and know, you know, when you're willing to move with them and when you're not. Those kind of things, they're just so incremental, and that's stuff that being in school can't teach you. But school can give you an in, you know, and it can give you a very bulk.
During my profession, I always went to seminars and always just constantly learning. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to constantly stay on top of that.
And with massage, you have to have continuing education, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Break that down, because I remember you, this is something that I really wish they had in the tattoo industry, which is a universal, like, I call it a fuck you test. Like, basically a test to where you can go anywhere. Because with massage, right, you have people that get on cruise liners and will have to go international. And so they have to take this crazy test, right?
That's what I had to take. You have to pass the international test first. Mm-hmm. Then you can get your license from the state.
Oh, okay. You know, yeah, so it's required to just be a massage therapist in general?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a international test that you have to take. Yeah.
See, I wish they had that.
That was really, really hard. Then you have a general reciprocity, you know, for across, like you could get on a cruise line and all. You have to have that. Mm-hmm. But once you get your license in state, you can, and you have to keep that national license up. But you, if you want to do a cruise line thing,
right.
But you can drop that international certification, license, and then just stay with the state.
Right.
And that's what I've done. I've done that. So I wasn't planning on moving around or anything. Okay. So, but first you have to pass the big test.
Yeah, the crazy test.
The crazy test. So, yeah, not all the time do apprenticeships work out, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to be prepared for that. And, you know, as an apprentice, you may be more passionate than your mentor, you know?
Right.
And as a mentor, you have to also be prepared to not always be successful, you know, with people. I had people, like I said, I had this one girl. She said that I wasn't paying her enough money, you know, right off, and she wasn't going to be able to, you know, continue on with the apprenticeship. And she was late, like, all the time.
Right.
I mean, like, all the time she was late. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you what you want, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She needed to get, like, $15 an hour or something. I said, but here's the deal. I said, you never come in on time, you know, and I'm not going to start the apprenticeship with you. She was at the end of the 30 days. I'm going to give you another 30 days and I'll pay you what you want, you know, so that you can do this. But you have to be on time.
Right.
And if you're not on time, we're not going to do it.
Right.
You know, so she couldn't make it a week.
I mean, that's job 101. You got to show up.
Well, yeah. And especially when you're working a job that you are on a schedule, you
right.
know, you buy
yeah.
appointments, right?
Exactly. You're she wasting people's time.
Oh yeah, yeah. She couldn't come in on time. It was crazy.
Wow.
So yeah, so I mean, she was learning fine and she was a nice person and, you know, she seemed like smart enough, but she couldn't get there on time. And that's, like you said, that's number one. So, you know, there's different reasons people disappoint you. And I think I've done seven apprenticeships in my career, seven apprentices. I had someone very successful. They went on to get their own salon and, you know, and I felt really good about that because, you know, these were people that, you know, probably wouldn't have been able to make much of their life, you know, in general. They weren't real successful people at school. They weren't real successful in other jobs. But, you know, they were able to learn something and really get a way to take care of themselves. And I felt very good about that. And then, but you know, the disappointments are hard to take. And then you have people that, you know, you felt like you did a lot for them and then they would get to the point where, like, and part of my contracts I had with people
was talk about that. Cause that's good. Cause I think that, you know, outlining a contract,
I had a contract with them.
A good idea.
Yeah, once they completed the training and they got their license, that they had to stay with me for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they didn't do that. They would break the contract. And I would go after them.
Mm-hmm.
And also when they did leave after a year, that they had to be outside of a 5-mile radius.
Right, a non-compete.
A non-compete.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, what I taught them, because they had nothing when they came to me, that they wouldn't take it so close to me and compete with me.
Right.
Now, in non-competes, and it's really interesting because your great-grandfather was the one that actually, I don't know if you know this or not.
No, he made them.
He made, well, he had the first ever non-compete that he went to court with.
Right.
And he was...
that was outlined in Granddad's book, right?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And he worked for a company that they had a non-compete with him, and he left that company, but he started his own business, and it was nothing to do with what he was doing for them.
Right.
He went into, like, selling, like, shampoos, and he was almost like a full of brush guy, went door to door, but he was selling creams and lotions, and he was just an entrepreneur, you know. He just, you got it honestly.
Right.
Great-grandfather. And then your grandfather was an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And that's before he went into the juice business. And he, you know, it was a multi-billion dollar company, you know, nationwide.
Yep.
But he started that company. And so...
Which also has we'll get to it after this, but I'd like you to talk about that because you ultimately ended up creating your own hair products too.
Yeah, I did. So anyway...
Continue.
Yeah, so he went to court and proved that he wasn't selling anything. The non-compete has to be of something that is what, you know, you're competing with, mm-hmm. you know. So if somebody's doing hair within a certain area that you, when you do a contract, you want to make it specific, you know, mm-hmm. to a certain amount of a mile radius.
Right.
And that mile radius, if you went to court, would be different out here in the county than it would be in the city.
Correct.
So for like in the city, you might have in a 5 mile radius might be way too much to ask.
Yes. Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's probably 5 salons to a mile, you know,
right.
where out here you might have a 5 mile radius, you know, there might only be 2 salons, you know, in a 5 mile radius. So you might want to make it a 10 mile radius out
right.
to, you know, it depends on, you know, where you're at.
Right.
So
and the fairness.
And it's fair, right. So I set a 5 mile radius. So which meant they would have to go, we're in Eldersburg. Mm-hmm. That meant they had to go somewhere down in maybe Howard County, or they'd have to go up to Westminster or
right.
something like that. They couldn't be here in Eldersburg,
right.
is basically what a 5 mile radius was.
And that was for a year. Correct?
That was for a year,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And then after a year, I had one, Heather.
Mm-hmm.
She broke it.
Yep.
And she worked at Kathy's salon.
Yep. And Kathy and I are still really good friends. And
yep.
She knew you were going to come after her. She was
Oh,
I'm glad he came after me because it was true.
Well, it's
after
true.
I contacted
Kathy and
yep.
I said, look, you know, I don't want to do this to you, but
right.
you know, I'm a businessman and I'm not going to not come after
right.
you. You know that.
right.
And she was like, yeah, I get it. You know, so then Heather left there mm-hmm. because she's not supposed to be there.
Right.
And, because I was going to go after Kathy and Heather.
Right.
Because, see, that's right. Because the person that hires somebody in that situation, if they know
mm-hmm.
that they're not supposed to do that, then they're also liable,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, anyway, Heather moved and that was fine. And then she went back
right.
after a year and that was fine.
Yep.
And Heather and I are still friends.
Yes.
You know, she'll call me up and say, I don't have this product and I got to do this. Could you sell me this product?
Right.
You
know? Well, and she's, and yeah. And Kathy, I remember when she opened up her salon, she showed up with pizzas for everybody and was like, mm-hmm. I just want you to know I'm a local salon in the area and I hope we can have a good rapport.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
it was always that way between you and her as a good
yeah.
business owner.
Well, all the people around here, we get along,
yeah.
you know, the owners. Yeah,
yeah.
definitely. It's like you said, you know, everybody's got their own niche and,
yep.
you know.
And you can feed your friends then if that's how you do business.
Mm-hmm.
When you do it with respect and, you know, we're all trying to do it really well. So as
yeah.
long as we're all keeping our standards high and with a good morality about it,
yeah.
that I think is key. And that's really what I want to see in our industry as well, is that, you know, that I would like to have a little bit more consistency of what people get, or at least when people go into a place, they know what they should expect. You know, I don't think that that's something that's really
yeah.
relevant. I mean, it's becoming more and more the case as I think, you know, we're having educators in our industry, people who are, you know, as passionate about a legacy of their profession as you've been always in the way that you've dealt with things. And I was raised that way. Like, so for me that it just makes sense.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't do it any other way. And, you know, I think that especially if what you're dealing with is people and you're dealing with service, you have to have a very high morality about you and know the ripple effects of your actions. And to me, tattooing is so attached to our souls and, like, you know, it's a cathartic thing, you know, and much like hair, you know, people come to us and we're like their confessionals, you know,
yeah.
at times. And the things that they're getting done with us, the safety that they feel with us to give them something like that, it's something that you have to count as a very high honor to have this person's trust, but also really, really understand, you know, the responsibility of what you've been given. And
yeah, that's part of being, that's part of morality
mm-hmm.
is, you know, gossip is not good. I mean, you don't
yeah.
know, this person might be telling you something and someone else would sit in your chair and you talk about that person, you don't know. That might be their sister-in-law and or whatever. You don't know who that person is. And they told you things in confidence that you shouldn't be repeating. And and that's just not good. You shouldn't do that. So.
Well, I always liked how you managed us, too, because whenever there was a situation like that where two employees of yours were upset, I remember at least how you handled us was that, like, you'd call us all in and you were like, okay, we're gonna hash this out right here now. I'm gonna be here and I'm going to regulate this and we're gonna squash this now because this is not something that's gonna permeate through my salon. Yeah. And I can't have this. I have to have you guys loving each other, at least have respect amongst each other, because we all have to work together here. And I'm not going to be your father. So, and I think that a lot of that was teaching us how to handle our own conflicts too, of like letting us know where our boundaries were, that we were supposed to make sure that we were good with each other. And eventually, you know, you didn't have to sit down with us. We would just squash it on our own. But because,
you learn how to work it out.
Yeah. But because you kind of was going to make that a forced situation regardless, like, oh no, this is going to be hashed out. I'm not going to let toxicity, you know, run rampant in my salon. It's just not worth it.
Yeah, because it bleeds over into the work and people, the customers see it, you know.
Yeah, and then they get uncomfortable.
Sure,
And it affects their relaxation and their ability to feel, you know, seen, you know, because then it's not about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not good.
No.
And, you know, sometimes I have found that the beautiful thing about this industry, too, is, you know, I was telling Rico the other day, there was times that my clients helped me, you know, like they just wanted a haircut and to atone. But somehow, like, there's days that, you know, I wasn't having the best day. But just being honest with my client, you know, sometimes just through that admission that, like, hey, I'm sorry, I'm not having a really great day. And, you know, I'm low. They would engage and they would tell me about a situation where they were low. And then before I knew it, they completely, you know, changed my day so that I was better for the next client.
Well, that's the beauty of being in a service industry because not only do you get to know your clients, they get to know you.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do you get to know them, but you get to know their kids, and then you get to know their kids' kids. And if you've been in as long as I have, you know, you have several generations that you get to know. And they include you in their family discussions and, you know, because you do the whole family, and it's you're like part of their life, you know. And so, and that's...
And you're good mediation. Like I said, you know, I found myself a lot of the times just trying to help mediate, you know, a young kid with their parent and what each other's wants were and what, you know, they both were trying to accomplish and let them find peace between each other. And I do think that I helped some of those relationships, you know, find more balance just by being this weird
And again,
insertion.
That's the responsibility of your, you know, of your profession is that you have that influence on people, you know, and it can be good or bad, you know. So you really, you want to stay away from gossip and you want to just, you know, keep to put your best foot forward, you know, with people and stuff. So
when there was literature that you had around here all the time too, like in our break rooms, you had stuff like Who Moved My Cheese is a good book, and Being a Day Maker, which was written by an industry professional. You also took us to a seminar with Wayne Claybaugh, who wrote Be Nice or Else. And so you had all these people there that were pretty much like self-helpers, you know, like they were people who realized, you know, this efficacy of attitude and how catching it was and how its effect can, you know, that butterfly effect of, you know, you might see that your actions are small, you're just cutting someone's hair, but the ramifications of that moment can mean everything to somebody in their life. And it's critical. And, you know, you have experienced deaths of your clients. You've gone to funerals of your clients. You know, I know to date you go to, you visit certain clients that are too old to get to the salon, which is amazing. You know, like there's the way that you get connected to your community is so awesome when you, take a station there and when you allow yourself that kind of vulnerability and access, and you know, it becomes like the cyclical awesomeness that just helps feed itself. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's well, you know, it's the history of the of the hair industry itself. I mean, communities revolved around the barbershop as being the hub of the whole community, you know, the, what was going on, you know. You find out what's going on, you go get a haircut, you know, you find out about everything.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's always been. And some of the our founding fathers, you know, wrote about, you know, who they trusted about, you know, when they would try to make a decision for the country, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I trust my wife and I trust my barber, you know.
Yeah, it's like it's true.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's like, because as a barber or being a central part of the community, you get the feed, you know, you get fed by all the different what's going on with all the different people and all the different backgrounds of people. And so you are a hub of knowledge, you know, of what people's feelings are.
Moreover, you know, I mean, I know that you have, I know when I was a hairstylist, I've connected people with jobs before. Like, you know, I know my, first boyfriend, Adam, like a couple of his jobs came from just professionals that I knew that got their hair cut by me.
Yeah.
And then there was, you know, a young girl that I cut her hair and she was looking for work. And then I knew a family that was looking for a babysitter and I connected them and it ended up being a beautiful scenario. In fact, you know, because you know so many professionals, one of your hairstylist successes, one that went off to have her own salon, Dora, you helped her find her mate. You know, like, so it's one of these things that can be so cool if you leave yourself open to the beauty of what it can be. And to be, to me, like, you know, when you're talking about policy and politics and all these things, those things kind of get washed over when you have what you and I have learned to acquire is that you have your community. It, you know, if crap hits the fan and all falls out, I feel a lot less scared about things like that because I know how I've touched people. I know how I've impacted them. I know what I've meant to their lives. And I know that there will be people there that will care about my life because of what I've been to theirs.
Yeah, you have to, and I think that's a good point you're making. You have to realize how important you are to people.
Yeah,
and because that you really are, you know, as a person that's so involved in their life.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a very important.
It's huge.
And so you were saying something about branding, you know.
Yes,
and I. You know, along with how you conduct yourself and all that, too, and we were talking about products, and I developed my own products, my own product line, and I did it in a way that I didn't have, it wasn't like I had to, you know, go into a lab or anything. It just, there are companies out there that have formulas that, what I did was, it was a company named Liquid Technologies there in California. And I found them at a hair show that we were at. And so I wanted to develop my own product line. And the way I did it was I said, okay, I want to start out with a volumizing shampoo, a moisturizing shampoo and conditioners, and a mousse, a gel, and a hairspray. You know, so I had them send me their formulas, and they sent me like 10 volumizing shampoos.
Right.
And what I did was that I designed a protocol throughout the salon as to everybody would give me feedback on what which one of these 10 volumizing shampoos they like best. So I asked questions like, you know, what is it? What other product does it remind you of? Do you like the smell? Do you feel like it really performed? Or, you know, I did a basic design line of questioning about each one, and then we would pick one of the volumizing shampoos and then one of the moisturizing shampoos. And so it just developed into that, and then I got to pick what's called the byline on it, another the sales point, you know, you know, luxurious, made your hair feel luxurious and whatever. I could write exactly how to use it. I could write exactly what it did, all that dialogue I could write on the bottle. I couldn't write the ingredients, obviously, and I couldn't, but I could name it anyway. I named it.
You could pick your packaging.
Yeah, and I could pick the packaging, and not only the bottle, but the lid and the delivery system of it. You know, all that stuff. So it's you know, it's like your own product, but the formulas are there.
But that was in response to a couple things, wasn't it? One, it was a way for you to further your brand, A Second Glance, which was your salon. So mm-hmm. to have a product that was your brand was...
Well, each bottle had our address on right. it and our name on it. And,
exactly. Yeah. But it was also because you were also noticing that, you know, you wanted a middle ground kind of product for your clients right. as well. Right. Because you only carry very high-end products, but mm-hmm. you wanted something that was... comparable to those products, but maybe you could give them a budget-friendly
yep.
Access to really good quality products as well that furthered, you know, your ethics and things like that, and that also carried your brand. Moreover, it's not widely known, and that's where it kind of gets back to Granddad's business, is that most people don't know that they can create their own products. A lot of people mm-hmm. give so much power and license to product companies who really are just getting... you know, rich off of professionals.
Exactly. Well, you know, your grandfather, his company was the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So he bottled his product under many different names mm-hmm. that would come to him and say, you know, Giant Food, you know, all right. their drink, you know, or 7-Eleven, you know, their right. embassy products, you know, they were all using his products that mm-hmm. he developed, you know. So, yeah, it's just like that. So each bottle would have our address and mm-hmm. our name and plus the other thing was too, you're right about the middle ground, because I always found that you can have a very expensive product and you can have a cheaper product and then you have a middle ground product. Most people will buy the middle ground mm-hmm. because they figure, well, this is too expensive and too, you know, elaborate for me, but I feel I'm better than this cheap product, so
yeah.
I'll get the middle. It's right. it's just a sales pitch. Right. It automatically happens.
Yep.
And the other thing was, too, that I would get a product line, say Sebastian or Paul Mitchell or Nexus, and I would buy the entire line all
right.
the time. I would put out $7,000 to buy the complete line, you know,
mm-hmm.
so we had it all. But then I found that, you know, even though they had 20 products, I was only using maybe 8 or 9 of them were getting sold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the others would just sit on the shelf.
Right.
So I wanted to develop my own product line so that I could say that, you know, every one of them was what I would want them to use,
yep.
you know, and then I felt good about,
yep.
you know, this, I feel good about it, you know.
Besides the fact that it came to a point where, you know, it's not illegal to do this, but they started diversifying the product, where they
yeah.
weren't salon-only products. They would, you know, sell you on a really good product, but when you find out that you're now competing with Walmart...
Yeah, they were selling them everywhere.
Right,
yeah.
and you know, when, you know, you can only count on that sale of a person who just likes convenience more than anything, is like, well, I'm already here. I'm going to buy this thing because I don't want to hop over to Walmart to save $2.
Right.
But that's not everyone, and Walmart wasn't that far away.
Sure.
So that's crap, you know, like you to keep things in alignment, not only with, you said, the ethics of what you want your product to be, your company and everything, but also to compete, you know, like you can't
yeah.
compete with an industry that has no care about the people that made them rich, you know,
right.
that Paul Mitchell, you know, for example, like there's a whole bunch of industry professionals that raised that brand up. And then, you know, I mean, they can do what they want. It's legal.
Yeah.
But like to go and sell that to Walmart, who doesn't have the verbiage, the education, any of those things to instruct their clients about why that product's best for them. And all of that stuff. And then, you know, to undermarket so that professionals can't
compete.
Really make money,
sure.
you know, selling them anymore. It's kind of a slap in the face. So
yeah.
I think it's really good to have that information out there, especially if you're, you know, a business owner of Lisa Dahl, like I said, she is a business owner, a tattoo artist, and she does have her own products. And it was cool to see that she has that and everything. And she's doing it really cool. And I really like her business platform. I think it's very congruent with Tattooed Heart in a lot of ways. Like, you know, like I said, I like to, you know, feed my friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's doing that. And I think it's good for businesses to know that you have a lot of license within that to, you know, and it's good to diversify yourself. Like, you know, have a product that you sell along with it, you know, have a t-shirt, you know, have multi-tiered things that you can offer your clients, and you never know what, you know, what might take off from that.
Yeah.
And it could really uplift you. You know, you might have started out wanting to cut hair and then realize that you created this amazing product that uplifted you so much more than your own capabilities on a day-to-day basis cutting hair. And you can sell that more massively than you ever could, you know, spending actual tangible time and your own energy, your body, your own health,
yep,
cutting people's hair. It just allows you to have a lot more reach.
Yeah.
And it's good. It's good business practice. And if you're doing it the way that you did it, with a lot of ethics and morality, nobody's being hurt at that point. It's a win-win, and everybody's buying something that they're really happy about.
Yeah.
Yep. So you had asked about how we're going to wrap this up, and I think that you should give us a joke, because that's your thing. My dad's a big jokester, and he always had a joke, and I don't know if you, if one comes to mind that you think would be fun, but I think it's a good way to wrap.
Oh, man. Well.
Or a story of a client that you think really helped, you know, the joke that, that helped them, you know, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I actually had this one guy come to me and say that, you know, he wanted to bring a recorder and record our time together, because I would tell jokes. And it's kind of sad, because he did. He brought in the recorder, and it was the last time he ever came to me. He was a young guy. He's like 35, and he actually died.
Oh, no.
And never came back in after,
wow,
we did that session. It was terrible. I was like, God. But then I inherited his girlfriend, who was not a hard. Yeah, I didn't fire her, but you know, she
she didn't work out.
She didn't work out. Yeah. So, but so yeah, that's probably the story I'll tell. But I could, since it's around Christmas, I could tell the one about the Santa Claus letter.
Yeah.
That I just, yeah, yeah. So the letter read, "Dear Santa, this year, I would like you to bring me a big fat bank account and a very slim body. Last year, you got it backwards. Signed, plump and broke."
I love it. Okay. And that was the thing with Dad, is you always have seasonal ones. Like if it's Halloween, you got your Halloween fare.
Oh, yeah.
And what I really liked is that they were good icebreakers for kids. Like kids that just, you know,
yeah,
they weren't having it. Like they're like, I don't even want to be here. And you could always kind of get that little smirk out of them.
Yeah.
It opened them up. Well, I love you. And
love
thank you,
too,
for letting me interview you. This was cool.
It was my pleasure.
All right, folks, if you like this, please write into us. We would welcome your insights, and I hope this has a really nice ripple effect, hopefully when we get more followers. Bye.
If you would like to reach out to us at The Apprenticeship Diaries, we hope that you do. You can email us at theapprenticeshipdiaries@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram. The Instagram account is @the_apprenticeship_diaries. Please feel free to follow us. We hope that you do. We'd also like to grow platforms and have more listening venues. Please feel free to contact us any way you'd like, and definitely contact us if you'd like to interview. Thank you.